The teacher was amazed at the swift and total transformation of so many of her students whom she thought she knew so well. Mrs. Elliott concluded, "What had been marvelously cooperative, thoughtful children became nasty, vicious, discriminating little third graders. It was ghastly." Endorsing the final solution in Hawaii, ridding the world of misfits. Imagine that you are a college student at the University of Hawaii, Manoa campus, among 570 other students in any of several large evening school psychology classes. Tonight, your teacher, with his Danish accent, alters his usual lecture to reveal a threat to national security being created by the population explosion, a hot topic in the early 1970s. This authority describes the emerging threat to society posed by the rapidly increasing number of people who are physically and mentally unfit. The problem is convincingly presented as a high-minded scientific project endorsed by scientists and planned for the benefit of humanity. You are then invited to help in the application of scientific procedures to eliminate the mentally and emotionally unfit. The teacher further justifies the need to take action with an analogy to capital punishment as a deterrent against violent crime. He tells you that your opinions are being solicited because you and the others assembled here are intelligent and well-educated and have high ethical values. It is flattering to think that you are in this select company. Recall the lure of C.S. Lewis's inner ring. In case there might be any lingering misgivings, he provides assurances that much careful research would be carried out before action of any kind would be taken with these misfit human creatures. At this point, he wants only your opinions, recommendations, and personal views on a simple survey to be completed now by you and the rest of the students in the auditorium. You begin answering the questions because you have been persuaded that this is a new vital issue about which your voice matters. You diligently answer each of the 7 questions and discover that there is a lot of uniformity between your answers and those of the rest of the group. 90% of you agree that there will always be some people more fit for survival than others. Regarding killing of the unfit, 79% wanted one person to be responsible for the killing and another to carry out the act. 64% preferred anonymity for those who pressed the button, with only one button causing death, though many were pressed. 89% judged that painless drugs would be the most efficient and humane method of inducing death. If required by law to assist, 89% wanted to be the one who assisted in the decisions, while 9% preferred to assist with the killings or both. Only 6% of the students refused to answer. Most incredibly, fully 91% of all student respondents agreed with the conclusion that, under extreme circumstances, it is entirely just to eliminate those judged most dangerous to the general welfare. Finally, a surprising 29% supported this final solution, even if it had to be applied to their own families. So these American college students, night school students, and thus older than usual, were willing to endorse a deadly plan to kill off all others who were judged by some authorities to be less fit to live than they were, after only a brief presentation by their teacher authority. Now we can see how ordinary, even intelligent Germans could readily endorse Hitler's final solution against the Jews, which was reinforced in many ways by their educational system and strengthened by systematic government propaganda. Ordinary men indoctrinated into extraordinary killing. One of the clearest illustrations of my exploration of how ordinary people can be made to engage in evil deeds that are alien to their past history and moral values comes from a remarkable discovery by the historian Christopher Browning. He recounts that in March 1942, about 80% of all victims of the Holocaust were still alive, but a mere 11 months later, about 80% were dead. In this short period of time, the Endlösung, Hitler's final solution, was energized by means of an intense wave of mobile mass murder squads in Poland. This genocide required mobilization of a large-scale killing machine at the same time that able-bodied German soldiers were needed on the collapsing Russian front. Because most Polish Jews lived in small towns and not large cities, the question that Browning raised about the German high command was, where had they found the manpower during this pivotal year of the war for such an astounding logistical achievement in mass murder? His answer came from archives of Nazi war crimes, which recorded the activities of Reserve Battalion 101, a unit of about 500 men from Hamburg, Germany. They were elderly family men, too old to be drafted into the army. They came from working-class and lower-middle-class backgrounds, and they had no military police experience. They were raw recruits sent to Poland without warning of or any training in their secret mission, the total extermination of all Jews living in the remote villages of Poland. In just 4 months, they shot to death at point-blank range at least 38,000 Jews and had another 45,000 deported to the concentration camp at Treblinka. Initially, their commander told them that this was a difficult mission that must be obeyed by the battalion. However, he added that any individual could refuse to execute these men, women, and children. The records indicate that at first, about half the men refused and let the other police reservists engage in the mass murder. But over time, social modeling processes took over, as did guilt-induced persuasion by those reservists who had been doing the shooting, along with the usual group conformity pressures of how would they be seen in the eyes of their comrades. By the end of their deadly journey, up to 90% of the men in Battalion 101 were blindly obedient to their battalion leader and were personally involved in the shootings. Many of them posed proudly for photographs of their up-close and personal killing of Jews. Like those who took photos of the prisoner abuse at Abu Ghraib prison, these policemen posed in their trophy photos as proud destroyers of the Jewish menace. Browning makes it clear that there was no special selection of these men, nor self-selection, nor self-interest or careerism that could account for these mass murders. Instead, they were as ordinary as can be imagined, until they were put into a novel situation in which they had official permission and encouragement to act sadistically against people who were arbitrarily labeled as the enemy. What is most evident in Browning's penetrating analysis of these daily acts of human evil is that these ordinary men were part of a powerful authority system, a political police state with ideological justifications for destroying Jews and intense indoctrination of the moral imperatives of discipline and loyalty and duty to the state. Interestingly, for the argument that I've been making that experimental research can have real-world relevance, Browning compared the underlying mechanisms operating in that far-off land at that distant time to the psychological processes at work in both the Milgram obedience studies and our Stanford prison experiment. The author goes on to note, Zimbardo's spectrum of guard behavior bears an uncanny resemblance to the groupings that emerged within Reserve Police Battalion 101, page 168. He shows how some became sadistically cruel and tough, enjoying the killing, whereas others were tough but fair in playing the rules, and a minority qualified as good guards who refused to kill and did small favors for the Jews. The psychologist Erwin Staub, who as a child survived the Nazi occupation of Hungary in a protected house, concurs that most people under particular circumstances have a capacity for extreme violence and destruction of human life. From his attempt to understand the roots of evil in genocide and mass violence around the world, Staub has come to believe that evil that arises out of ordinary thinking and is committed by ordinary people is the norm, not the exception. Great evil arises out of ordinary psychological processes that evolve, usually with a progression along the continuum of destruction. He highlights the significance of ordinary people being caught up in situations where they can learn to practice evil acts that are demanded by higher-level authority systems. Being part of a system shapes views, rewards adherence to dominant views, and makes deviations psychologically demanding and difficult. Having lived through the horrors of Auschwitz, John Steiner, my dear friend and sociologist colleague, returned for decades to Germany to interview hundreds of former Nazi SS men, from privates to generals. He needed to know what had made these men embrace such unspeakable evil day in and day out. Steiner found that many of these men were high on the F-scale measure of authoritarianism, which attracted them to the subculture of violence in the SS. He refers to them as sleepers, people with certain traits that are latent and may never be expressed, except when particular situations activate these violent tendencies. He concludes that the situation tended to be the most immediate determinant of SS behavior, rousing sleepers into active killers. However, from his massive interview data, Steiner also found that these men had led normal, violence-free lives both before and after their violent years in the concentration camp setting. Steiner's extensive experience with many of the SS men at a personal and scholarly level led him to advance two important conclusions about institutional power and the role enactment of brutality. Institutional support for roles of violence has apparently far more extensive effects than generally realized. When implicit, and especially explicit, social sanctions support such roles, people tend to be attracted to them who may not only derive satisfaction from the nature of their work, but are quasi-executioners in feeling as well as action. Steiner goes on to describe how roles can trump character traits. It has become evident that not everyone playing a brutal role has to have sadistic traits of character. Those who continued in roles originally not conducive to their personality often changed their values, i.e., had a tendency to adjust to what was expected of them in these roles. There were SS members who clearly identified with and enjoyed their positions. Finally, there were those who were repulsed and sickened by what they were ordered to do. They tried to compensate by helping inmates whenever possible. This writer's life was saved by SS personnel on several occasions. It is important to acknowledge that many hundreds of thousands of Germans who became perpetrators of evil during the Holocaust were not doing so simply because they were following the orders given by authorities. Obedience to an authority system that gave permission and reward for murdering Jews was built on a scaffold of intense anti-Semitism that existed in Germany and other European nations at that time. This prejudice was given direction and resolve by the German chain of command to ordinary Germans, who became Hitler's willing executioners in the analysis by the historian Daniel Goldhagen. Although it is important to note the motivating role of Germans' hatred of Jews, Goldhagen's analysis suffers from two flaws. First, historical evidence shows that from the early 19th century on, there was less anti-Semitism in Germany than in neighboring countries such as France and Poland. He also errs in minimizing the influence of Hitler's authority system, a network that glorified racial fanaticism and the particular situations created by the authorities, like the concentration camps, which mechanized genocide. It was the interaction of personal variables of German citizens with situational opportunities provided by a system of fanatical prejudice that combined to empower so many to become willing or unwilling executioners for their state. The banality of evil. In 1963, the social philosopher Hannah Arendt published what was to become a classic of our times, Eichmann in Jerusalem, a report on the banality of evil. She provides a detailed analysis of the war crimes trial of Adolf Eichmann, the Nazi figure who personally arranged for the murder of millions of Jews. Eichmann's defense of his actions was similar to the testimony of other Nazi leaders. "I was only following orders." As Arendt put it, Eichmann remembered perfectly well that he would have had a bad conscience only if he had not done what he had been ordered to do, to ship millions of men, women, and children to their death with great zeal and the most meticulous care. Page 25. However, what is most striking in Arendt's account of Eichmann is all the ways in which he seemed absolutely ordinary. Half a dozen psychiatrists had certified him as normal. More normal, at any rate, than I am after having examined him, one of them was said to have exclaimed, while another had found that his whole psychological outlook, his attitude toward his wife and children, mother and father, brothers, sisters, and friends, was not only normal, but most desirable. Pages 25 through 26. Through her analysis of Eichmann, Arendt reached her famous conclusion. The trouble with Eichmann was precisely that so many were like him, and that the many were neither perverted nor sadistic, that they were, and still are, terribly and terrifyingly normal. From the viewpoint of our legal institutions and our moral standards of judgment, this normality was much more terrifying than all the atrocities put together, for it implied that this new type of criminal commits his crimes under circumstances that make it well-nigh impossible for him to know or feel that he is doing wrong. Page 276. It was as though in those last minutes of Eichmann's life he was summing up the lesson that this long course in human wickedness had taught us, the lesson of the fearsome, word- and thought-defying banality of evil. Page 252. Arendt's phrase, "the banality of evil," continues to resonate because genocide has been unleashed around the world, and torture and terrorism continue to be common features of our global landscape. We prefer to distance ourselves from such a fundamental truth, seeing the madness of evildoers and senseless violence of tyrants as dispositional characters within their personal makeup. Arendt's analysis was the first to deny this orientation by observing the fluidity with which social forces can prompt normal people to perform horrific acts. Torturers and executioners. Pathological types or situational imperatives. There is little doubt that the systematic torture by man of their fellow men and women represents one of the darkest sides of human nature. Surely, my colleagues and I reasoned, here was a place where dispositional evil would be manifest, among torturers who did their daily dirty deeds for years in Brazil as policemen sanctioned by the government to get confessions by torturing subversive enemies of the state. We began by focusing on the torturers, trying to understand both their psyches and the ways they were shaped by their circumstances, but we had to expand our analytical net to capture their comrades in arms who chose or were assigned to another branch of violence work, death squad exterminators. They shared a common enemy, men, women, and children who, though citizens of their state, even neighbors, were declared by the system to be threats to the country's national security as socialists and communists. Some had to be eliminated efficiently, while others, who might hold secret information, had to be made to yield it up by torture, confess to their treason, and then be killed. In carrying out this mission, these torturers could rely in part on the creative evil embodied in torture devices and techniques that had been refined over centuries since the Inquisition by officials of the Catholic Church and later of many nation-states. However, they had to add a measure of improvisation when dealing with particular enemies to overcome their resistance and resiliency. Some of them claimed innocence, refused to acknowledge their culpability, or were tough enough not to be intimidated by most coercive interrogation tactics. It took time and emerging insights into human weaknesses for these torturers to become adept at their craft. By contrast, the task of the death squads was easy. With hoods for anonymity, guns, and group support, they could dispatch their duty to country swiftly and impersonally. Just business. For a torturer, the work could never be just business. Torture always involves a personal relationship. It is essential for the torturer to understand what kind of torture to employ, what intensity of torture to use on a certain person at a certain time. Wrong kind or too little, no confession. Too much, the victim dies before confessing. In either case, the torturer fails to deliver the goods and incurs the wrath of the senior officers. Learning to determine the right kind and degree of torture that yields up the desired information elicits abounding rewards and flowing praise from one's superiors. What kind of man could do such deeds? Did they need to rely on sadistic impulses and a history of sociopathic life experiences to rip and tear the flesh of fellow beings day in and day out for years on end? Were these violence workers a breed apart from the rest of humanity? Bad seeds, bad tree trunks, and bad flowers? Or is it conceivable that they could be ordinary people, programmed to carry out their deplorable acts by means of some identifiable and replicable training programs? Could we identify a set of external conditions, situational variables, that had contributed to the making of these torturers and killers? If their evil actions were not traceable to inner defects, but rather attributable to outer forces acting on them, the political, economic, social, historical, and experiential components of their police training, we might be able to generalize across cultures and settings and discover some of the operative principles responsible for this remarkable human transformation. The sociologist and Brazil expert Martha Huggins, the Greek psychologist and torture expert Mika Haritos-Fatouros, and I interviewed several dozen of these violence workers in depth at various venues in Brazil. For a summary of our methods and detailed findings about these violence workers, see Huggins, Haritos-Fatouros, and Zimbardo. Mika had done a similar earlier study of torturers trained by the Greek military junta, and our results were largely congruent with hers. We found that sadists are selected out of the training process by trainers because they are not controllable, get off on the pleasure of inflicting pain, and thus do not sustain the focus on the goal of extraction of confessions. Thus, from all the evidence we could muster, torturers and death squad executioners were not unusual or deviant in any way prior to practicing their new roles, nor were there any persisting deviant tendencies or pathologies among any of them in the years following their work as torturers and executioners. Their transformation was entirely explainable as being the consequence of a number of situational and systemic factors, such as the training they were given to play this new role, their group camaraderie, acceptance of the national security ideology, and their learned belief in socialists and communists as enemies of their state. Other situational influences contributing to the new behavioral style included being made to feel special, above and better than their peers in public service, by being awarded this special assignment. The secrecy of their duties being shared only with comrades in arms, and the constant pressure to produce results regardless of fatigue or personal problems. We reported many detailed case studies that document the ordinariness of the men engaged in these most heinous of acts, sanctioned by their government, and secretly supported by the CIA at that point in the Cold War, 1964 through 1985, against Soviet communism. The account, Torture in Brazil, by members of the Catholic Archdiocese of Sao Paulo, provides detailed information of the extensive involvement of CIA agents in the torture training of Brazilian police. Such information is consistent with all that is known of the systematic instruction in interrogation and torture offered at the School of the Americas to operatives from countries sharing a common enemy in communism. However, my colleagues and I believe that such deeds are reproducible at any time in any nation when there is an obsession with threats to national security. Before the fears and excesses engendered by the recent war against terrorism, there was the nearly perpetual war against crime in many urban centers. In New York City's police department, that war spawned the commandos of the NYPD. This insular police team was given free rein to hunt down alleged rapists, robbers, and muggers as local conditions dictated. They wore T-shirts with their motto, "There is no hunting like the hunting of men." Their battle cry was, "We own the night." Such a professionalized police culture was comparable to that of the Brazilian police torturers we had studied. One of their notable atrocities was the murder of an African immigrant, Amadou Diallo, from Guinea, gunning him down with more than 40 bullets while he tried to pull out his wallet to give them his ID. Sometimes bad shit happens, but usually there are identifiable situational and systemic forces operating to make it happen. Suicide bombers, mindless fanatics, or mindful martyrs. Amazingly, what holds true for these violence workers is comparable to the transformation of young Palestinians from students into suicide bombers intent on killing innocent Israeli civilians. Recent media accounts converge on the findings from more systematic analyses of the process of becoming a suicidal killer. Who adopts this fatalistic role? Is it poor, desperate, socially isolated, illiterate young people with no career and no future? Not at all. According to the results of a recent study of 400 Al-Qaeda members, three-quarters of that sample came from the upper or middle class. This study by the forensic psychiatrist Mark Sageman also found other evidence of the normality and even superiority of these youths turned suicide bombers. The majority, 90%, came from caring, intact families. Two-thirds had gone to college, two-thirds were married, and most had children and jobs in science and engineering. "These are the best and brightest of their society in many ways," Sageman concludes. Anger, revenge, and outrage at perceived injustice are the motivational triggers for deciding to die for the cause. People desire death when two fundamental needs are frustrated to the point of extinction, according to the psychologist Thomas Joyner in his treatise Why People Die by Suicide. The first need is one we have pointed to as central to conformity and social power, the need to belong with or connect to others. The second need is the need to feel effective with or to influence others. Ariel Merari, an Israeli psychologist who has studied this phenomenon extensively for many years, outlines the common steps on the path to these explosive deaths. First, senior members of an extremist group identify young people who appear to have an intense patriotic fervor based on their declarations at a public rally against Israel or their support of some Islamic cause or Palestinian action. Next, they are invited to discuss how seriously they love their country and hate Israel. They are asked to commit to be trained. Those who do commit become part of a small, secret cell of 3 to 5 youths. They learn the tricks of the trade from their elders, bomb-making, disguise, and selecting and timing targets. Finally, they make public their private commitment by making a videotape, declaring themselves to be the living martyr for Islam, al-Shahid al-Hay. In one hand, they hold the Quran, in the other a rifle. The insignia on their headband declares their new status. This video binds them to the final deed because it is sent to their families. The recruits are also told the big lie that not only will they earn a place beside Allah, but their relatives will also be entitled to a high place in heaven because of their martyrdom. The suicidal pie is sweetened with a sizable financial incentive or a monthly pension that goes to their family. Their photo is emblazoned on posters that will be put on walls everywhere in the community the moment they succeed in their mission, to become inspirational models for the next round of suicide bombers. To stifle their concerns about the pain from wounds inflicted by exploding nails and other bomb parts, the recruits are assured that before the first drop of their blood touches the ground, they will already be seated at the side of Allah, feeling no pain, only pleasure. The die is cast. Their minds have been carefully prepared to do what is ordinarily unthinkable. Of course, the rhetoric of dehumanization serves to deny the humanity and innocence of their victims. In these systematic ways, a host of normal, angry young men and women become transformed into heroes and heroines. Their lethal actions model self-sacrifice and total commitment as true believers to the cause of the oppressed. That message is sent loud and clear to the next cadre of young suicide bombers in waiting. We can see that this program utilizes a variety of social, psychological, and motivational principles to assist in turning collective hatred and general frenzy into a dedicated, seriously calculated program of indoctrination and training for individuals to become youthful living martyrs. It is neither mindless nor senseless, only a very different mindset and with different sensibilities than we've been used to witnessing among young adults in most countries. For his new film, Suicide Killers, the French filmmaker Pierre Rehove interviewed many Palestinians in Israeli jails who were caught before detonating their bombs or had abetted would-be attacks. His conclusion about them resonates with the analyses presented here. Every single one of them tried to convince me it was the right thing to do for moralistic reasons. These aren't kids who want to do evil. These are kids who want to do good. The result of this brainwashing was kids who were very good people inside, were, believing so much that they were doing something great. The suicide, the murder, of any young person is a gash in the fabric of the human family that we elders from every nation must unite to prevent. To encourage the sacrifice of youth for the sake of advancing the ideologies of the old must be considered a form of evil that transcends local politics and expedient strategies. Perfect 9/11 soldiers and ordinary British lads are bombing us. Two final examples of the ordinariness of mass murderers are worth mentioning. The first comes from an in-depth study of the 9/11 hijackers, whose suicidal terrorist attacks in New York and Washington, D.C. resulted in the deaths of nearly 3,000 innocent civilians. The second comes from the London police reports of suspected suicide bombers of London's underground and a double-decker bus in June 2005 that resulted in scores of deaths and serious injuries. The carefully researched portraits of several of the 9/11 terrorists by the reporter Terry McDermott in Perfect Soldiers underscores just how ordinary these men were in their everyday lives. His research led McDermott to an ominous conclusion. It is likely that there are a great many more men just like them out there throughout the world. One review of this book takes us back to Arendt's Banality of Evil thesis, updated for our new era of global terrorism. The New York Times reviewer Michiko Kakutani offers us a scary postscript. Perfect Soldiers replaces the caricatures of outsize evil geniuses and wild-eyed fanatics with portraits of the 9/11 plotters as surprisingly mundane people, people who might easily be our neighbors or airplane seatmates. That frightening scenario was played out in the subsequent coordinated attacks on London's transit system by a team of suicide bombers, mundane murderers, who anonymously rode a subway train or a bus. To their friends, relatives, and neighbors in the northern England city of Leeds, these young Muslim men were ordinary British lads. Nothing in their past history would mark them as dangerous. Indeed, everything about them enabled these ordinary lads to fit in seamlessly in their town, at their jobs. One was a skilled cricket player who gave up drinking and women to lead a more devout life. Another was the son of a local businessman who ran a fish and chip shop. Another was a counselor who worked effectively with disabled children and had recently become a father and moved his family into a new home. Unlike the 9/11 hijackers, who had raised some suspicions as foreigners seeking flight training in the United States, these young men were homegrown, flying well below any police radar. It's completely out of character for him. Someone must have brainwashed him and made him do it, reflected a friend of one of them. The most terrifying thing about suicide bombers is their sheer normality, concludes Andrew Silke, an expert on the subject. He notes that in all the forensic examinations of the bodies of dead suicide bombers, there have never been traces of alcohol or drugs. Their mission is undertaken with a clear mind and dedication. And, as we have seen, whenever there has been a student shooting in a school, as in Columbine High School in the United States, Those who thought they knew the perpetrators typically report, "He was such a good kid, from a respectable family. You just can't believe he would do it." This harkens back to the point I raised in our first chapter. How well do we really know other people? And its corollary, how well do we know ourselves to be certain of how we would behave in novel situations under intense situational pressures? The ultimate test of blind obedience to authority. Killing your children on command. Our final extension of the social psychology of evil from artificial laboratory experiments to real-world contexts comes to us from the jungles of Guyana, where an American religious leader persuaded more than 900 of his followers to commit mass suicide or be killed by their relatives and friends on November 28, 1978. Jim Jones, the pastor of People's Temple congregations in San Francisco and Los Angeles, set out to create a socialist utopia in this South American nation, where brotherhood and tolerance would be dominant over the materialism and racism he loathed in the United States. But over time and place, Jones was transformed from the caring spiritual father of this large Protestant congregation into an angel of death, a truly cosmic transformation of Luciferian proportions. For now, I want only to establish the obedience to authority link between Milgram's basement laboratory in New Haven and this jungle killing field. The dreams of the many poor members of the People's Temple for a new and better life in this alleged utopia were demolished when Jones instituted extended forced labor, armed guards, total restriction of all civil liberties, semi-starvation diets, and daily punishments amounting to torture for the slightest breach of any of his many rules. When concerned relatives convinced a congressman to inspect the compound, along with a media crew, Jones arranged for them to be murdered as they were leaving. He then gathered almost all of the members who were at the compound and gave a long speech in which he exhorted them all to take their lives by drinking poison, cyanide-laced Kool-Aid. Those who refused were forced to drink by the guards or shot trying to escape, but it appears as though most obeyed their leader. Jones was surely an egomaniac. He had all of his speeches and proclamations and even his torture sessions tape-recorded, including this last-hour suicide drill. In it, Jones distorts reality, lies, pleads, makes false analogies, appeals to ideology and to transcendent future lives, and outright insists that they follow his orders, as his staff is efficiently distributing the deadly poison to the more than 900 members gathered around him. Some excerpts from that last hour convey a sense of the death-dealing tactics he used to induce total obedience to an authority gone mad. "Please get us some medication. It's simple. It's simple. There's no convulsions with it." Of course there are, especially for the children. "Don't be afraid to die. You'll see, there'll be a few people land out here. They'll torture some of our children here. They'll torture our people. They'll torture our seniors. We cannot have this. Please, can we hasten? Can we hasten with that medication? You don't know what you've done. I tried. Please. For God's sake, let's get on with it. We've lived as no other people lived and loved. We've had as much of this world as you're gonna get. Let's just be done with it. Let's be done with the agony of it." Applause. "Who wants to go with their child has a right to go with their child. I think it's humane. I want to go. I want to see you go, though. It's not to be feared. It is not to be feared. It is a friend. It's a friend. Sitting there, show your love for one another. Let's get gone. Let's get gone. Let's get gone." Children crying. "Lay down your life with dignity. Don't lay down with tears and agony. There's nothing to death. It's just stepping over to another plane. Don't be this way. Stop this hysterics. No way for us to die. We must die with some dignity. We must die with some dignity. We will have no choice. Now we have some choice. Look, children, it's just something to put you to rest. Oh, God! Children crying. Mother, 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 please, mother, please, 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 don't do this, don't do this. Lay down your life with your child. The full transcript is available online. And they did, and they died for Dad. The power of charismatic, tyrannical leaders like Jim Jones and Adolf Hitler endures even after they do terrible things to their followers, and even after their demise. Whatever little good they may have done earlier somehow comes to dominate the legacy of their evil deeds in the minds of the faithful. Consider the example of a young man, Gary Scott, who followed his father into the People's Temple, but was expelled for being disobedient. In his statement, as he called the national call-in following the broadcast of the NPR show Father Cares, The Last of Jonestown, by James Reston Jr., Gary describes how he was punished for an infraction of the rules. He was beaten, whipped, sexually abused, and forced to endure his worst fear of having a boa constrictor crawling all over him. But more important, listen to the articulation of his enduring reaction to this torment. Does he hate Jim Jones? Not one bit. He has become a true believer, a faithful follower. Even though his father died in Jonestown at that poison fount, and he himself was brutally tortured and humiliated, Gary publicly states that he still admires and even loves his dad, Jim Jones. Not even George Orwell's omnipotent 1984 party could honestly claim such a victory. Now we need to go beyond conformity and authority obedience. Powerful as these are, they are only starters. In the confrontation of potential perpetrators and victims, like guard and prisoner, torturer and sufferer, suicide bomber and civilian victims, there are processes that operate to change the psychological makeup of one or the other. De-individuation makes the perpetrator anonymous, thereby reducing personal accountability, responsibility, and self-monitoring. This allows perpetrators to act without conscience-inhibiting limits. Dehumanization takes away the humanity of potential victims, rendering them as animal-like or as nothing. We will also inquire about conditions that make bystanders to evil become passive observers and not active intruders, helpers, or whistleblowing heroes. That slice of the evil of inaction is really a cornerstone of evil because it allows perpetrators to believe that others who knew what was going on accepted and approved it, even if only by their silence. A fitting conclusion to our investigation of the social dynamics of conformity and obedience comes from the Harvard psychologist Mazarin Banaji. What social psychology has given to an understanding of human nature is the discovery that forces larger than ourselves determine our mental life and our actions. Chief among these forces is the power of the social situation.